Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 1 through 32, the entire chapter. I'll call it Love and Obey the Lord. Our context is this. In Deuteronomy 10, the last chapter, we see Moses recounting his experience at Mount Sinai when he had to make new tablets of stone to put into Bezalel's ark, and then Moses' request that the Israelites circumcise their heart. So now we start in Deuteronomy 11, verses 1 through 4. Therefore, love the Lord your God and always keep his mandate and his statutes, ordinances, and commands. You must understand today that it is not your children who experience to saw the discipline of the Lord your God, his greatness, strong hand, and outstretched arm, his signs and the works he did in Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and all his land. What he did to Egypt's army, its horses and chariots, when he made the waters of the Red Sea flow over them as they pursued you, and he destroyed them completely. Well, once again, Moses, remember he's giving his second discourse to the people. His second discourse was basically involved with the law. He recounts the events surrounding the giving of the law, and then he gives some details about the law, and then he mainly emphasizes keep the law, as we'll see this over and over again, and that's the theme of this chapter, which is loving and obeying the Lord by keeping his law, by obeying his law. So he says in verse 1, keep his mandate, keep it, keep his statutes, ordinances, and commands. All those are same, as far as I'm concerned, are synonyms for the law. Keep them. Now notice how close keep is to love. In verse 1, Moses says to the people, love the Lord, and then he says, keep his commandments. Doesn't that sound familiar? Remember John chapter 14, verse 15? Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Deuteronomy 10, 12 in our last chapter said this, and now Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you except to fear the Lord your God by walking in all his ways, that means to keep his commands, to love him. So there's keeping in his commands juxtaposed with loving God. Now, this idea of loving God by keeping God's commands is something somewhat alien to the Western romantic notion that love is a fluttery feeling in your heart, a mere infatuation, emotions and feelings which last about 5 minutes compared to a lifetime of devotion of service with works. We need to remember that. Love is doing. It's just not feeling. There's nothing wrong with feelings. But in the scripture, it's mostly about doing. That's what love is. Now, this idea of obeying the commandments, as I said, is repeated a lot in Deuteronomy, especially in that middle discourse of Moses to the people. Israel was in an infant stage. They were headstrong. They were rebellious. They were like children, and they had to be told over and over again, keep your hands out of the cookie jar, Israelites. Verse 2, the Holman Christian Study Bible has this, you must understand today. And then Moses goes on to talk about what happened in Egypt at the Exodus. Well, that understand in the Holman Christian Study Bible is rendered remember in the NIV. And that's a common theme in Deuteronomy. Moses always goes back to what happened on the Exodus as using those events in the past on the Exodus as object lessons for the Israelites. Now I'm going to briefly run through very quickly all the places in Deuteronomy where we see Moses talking, exhorting the Israelites to remember what happened in the past. Some things were bad, like they were slaves. Some things were good. But the history of the Exodus was a great object lesson for the Israelites. Deuteronomy 5:15, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Deuteronomy 7:18, you shall not be afraid of them. You shall well remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh. Deuteronomy 8:2, you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years. Deuteronomy 8:18, but you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you the power to make wealth. Deuteronomy 9:7, remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. Deuteronomy 9:27, remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Deuteronomy 15:15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 16:3, you shall not eat leavened bread with it, with the Passover. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. The Passover was a memory aid. Deuteronomy 16:12, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:9, remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way you came out of Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:18, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. And that's something the Israelites forgot a lot, that they were slaves. Remember, they wanted to go back to the leeks and the garlics of Egypt where Everything was so nice and fine. No problems. There was peace. There were slaves. And so God says, you want to go back to Egypt? There was slaves. You were slaves in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 25:17. Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt. They attacked them and roughed them. Deuteronomy 32:7. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. All right, so this idea of remembering is very, very prominent in Deuteronomy, and it provides a great object lesson for Christians today. Remember all through your past life what God has done for you. So if you want to be tempted to go back to your past life, to get together with your old girlfriend, to go back to your old ungodly ways, whatever it is, remember, you were a slave then. And remember all the times the Lord delivered you. Now in verse 2, Moses says this, you must understand today, you must remember today, that it is not your children who experienced and saw the discipline of the Lord your God. Why would Moses say that? Well, first of all, as a matter of fact, it was not even them, a lot of them, who saw the discipline of the Lord your God. Because remember, all warriors, all males over 20 who weren't in the tribe of Levi, had died before they crossed the Zered Brook south of Moab on the way in, and that's because they were doomed by God to die in the sand of the wilderness because they believe the evil report of the cowardly spies, the 10 spies, you recall that. But that was only male warriors over 20. Those who were standing there actually had seen, a lot of the people who were standing there had actually seen all the events of the Exodus that Moses was talking about, including the original escape from Egypt. For example, all the women, all the children, all the Levites, and actually anybody under 20. So what he's saying is, it's not your children. This is not a far-off generation who saw this. You saw it. So you need to take to heart the object lessons that you saw about how God completely destroyed Pharaoh. Remember that as you go into the land of Egypt and have to conquer these seven Canaanite nations who are stronger than you, probably individually stronger than the Israelites. We go now to Deuteronomy 11, verses 5 through 7. Moses continues to remind the Israelites of what he did to you in the wilderness until you reached this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab the Reubenite. When in the middle of the whole Israelite camp, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them, their households, their tents, and every living thing with them. Your own eyes have seen every great work the Lord has done. So he starts out mentioning the good news, the escape from Egypt and how powerful God was. Then he mentions the chastisement of the Israelites, the bad news, right here in verses 5 through 7. Because he says in verse 5, remember what he did to you. As John Gill says, that's referring to chastisements, not good things, when it says to you. He recalls what God did to Dathan and Abiram. Now, Dathan and Abiram were involved in Korah's rebellion. Let's read some scriptures. This is in number 16, verse 1. Now, Korah, son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab and On, sons of Pelah, blah, 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 blah. And so there we see Korah, Dathan, and Abiram linked together in rebellion. We go down to verse 30 and verse number 16. But if the Lord brings about something unprecedented and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them along with all that belongs to them so that they go down alive into Sheol, then you will know that these men have despised the Lord. And of course, if you read the story in its entirety, that's exactly what happened. There was not only an earthquake, a splitting of the land, there was also a fire came down from heaven, maybe lightning. It's not clear which one of those two disasters caught up Korah. I think he probably went down in the fire, but Dathan and Abiram and their relatives went down in the earthquake. So anyway, the Israelites were reminded of the chastisements. Again, the idea is to keep these Israelites obeying the Lord and loving the Lord. Stay true to the covenant. In verse 6, Moses says that there, Dathan and Abiram's households went down into the earth. That doesn't mean their tents. That means their families. So it was not just the leaders of the rebellion, but their families too. Once again, illustrating the principle that the sins of the fathers, when you're a father, your kids suffer from what you do. They're blessed for what you do if you do good, but they suffer if you do bad. Hardest thing in the world is for individuals to escape the sins of their fathers. Deuteronomy 11, 8 through 12. Keep every command I am giving you today so that you may have the strength to cross into and possess the land you are to inherit, and so that you may live long in the land the Lord swore to your fathers to give them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land you are entering to possess is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and irrigated by hand as in a vegetable garden. But the land you are entering to possess is a land of mountains and valleys, watered by rain from the sky. It is a land the Lord your God cares for. He is always watching over it from the beginning to the end of the year. Now notice that there's a result of keeping God's command in verse 8. Keep every command so that you may have strength to cross into the land. Keeping God's commands will make you strong. Notice also in verse 9 there's another good benefit from keeping the commands. And so that you may live long in the land. Keeping God's commands will make one live long. In general, I'm not saying it applies to every individual. Now, when Moses tells the Israelites that you may live long, he could be talking about each individual Israelite will live a long time, as the NIV study Bible suggests as an option. But it also could mean that Israel will have a long national existence in the land. I tend to think that that's probably what it is, although it's not really clear. Let's look at some other scriptures promising long life for the Israelites if they obey God's commands. Deuteronomy 4:40. Keep his statutes and commands, which I'm giving you today, so that you and your children after you may prosper and so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you for all time. Deuteronomy 5:16, honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you so that you may live long and so that you may prosper in the land the Lord your God is giving you. Deuteronomy 5:33, follow the whole instruction the Lord your God has commanded you so that you may live, prosper, and have a long life in the land you will possess. Deuteronomy 4:26, I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today that you will quickly perish from the land you are about to cross the Jordan to possess. You will not live long there. Now this is the negative of it, of the idea. If you don't keep the law, you're not going to live long. So the idea is ingrained in Deuteronomy, in Moses. You keep the law, you live long. Of course, Paul mentioned that in Ephesians 6 when he said that was the only commandment with a promise that you live long, honor your father and mother. So keeping God's commandments brings good results. Now a minor detail here. In verse 10, Moses says the land you're entering to possess is not like the land of Egypt, where you sowed your seed and irrigated by hand, the Holman Christian Study Bible has. Actually, the original there is foot, where you sowed your seed and irrigated by foot. Now, that's confusing to the Western ear. Why does it say foot? Well, there's some options as to what that means. The NIV Study Bible says that irrigation channels in Egypt were supplied by foot power, and so that's what it meant by foot. Now, by foot power, that could mean dug by foot, that those trenches were dug by foot. I don't know why you would dig with your feet. I don't know, but that's one option. More likely, it could mean that the irrigation channels were fed by devices powered by the foot. I've seen these in China. They're primitive pumps, but if you pump pedal on them, it turns water wheels that suck the water out of the ditches or out of the main ditch into the subsidiary ditch. And likewise, they had these things in Egypt too. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about what that irrigated by foot might mean, but the main point here is that this is opposed to Canaan, this digging by foot or this irrigating by foot. It's a lot different than in Canaan because the water's going to come out of the sky in Canaan, which is a lot easier than having to dig irrigation ditches. In the land of Egypt, rain rarely fell, and they had to dig those ditches to get water from the Nile. Well, let me read you two speculations on what it means to irrigate by foot in Egypt. This is Adam Clark, quote, rain scarcely ever falls in Egypt, and God supplies the lack of it by the inundations of the Nile. In order to water the grounds where the inundations do not extend, water is collected in ponds and directed in streamlets to different parts of the field where irrigation is necessary. It is no unusual thing in the East to see a man with a small mattock making a little trench for the water to run by, and as he opens the passage, the water following, he uses his foot to raise up the mold against the side of this little channel. And I think what Clark means by raising the mold and raising up a border with the dirt, with his feet kicking the dirt up to make a border so that the water will stay in the channel, to prevent the water from being shed unnecessarily before it reaches the place of its destination. Thus, he may be said to water the ground with his foot. Well, that actually makes a lot of sense. Probably makes more sense than peddling a machine to make the water go into the irrigation ditch. Now, here's Jameson Fawcett and Brown's idea of what it means to irrigate by foot. Quote, "This natural want is supplied by the annual overflow of the Nile and by artificial means from the same source when the river has receded within its customary channel. Close by the bank, the process of irrigation is very simple. The cultivator opens a small sluice on the edge of the square bed in which seed has been sown, making drill after drill, and when a sufficient quantity of water has poured in, he shuts it up with his foot. When the bank is high, the water is drawn up by hydraulic engines, of which there are three kinds used of different power, according to the subsidence of the stream. The water is distributed in small channels or earthen conduits, simple in construction, worked by the foot, and formed with a mattock by the gardener who directs their course, which are banked up or opened as occasion may require by pressing in the soil with the foot." Well, Jameson Fawcett Brown basically says the same thing as Clark. You kick open the sluice gate, you let the water come in, the little ditches, and then you kick up a side bank on the side of the ditch so that the water would flow. That's a lot of trouble, folks. A lot of trouble, not like in Canaan. Verse 12, Moses says, "It is a land the Lord your God cares for." He cares for it because he makes it rain. The implication is he's caring for it. You don't need to work as hard when you were slaves in Egypt. Deuteronomy 11, verses 13 through 15. "If you carefully obey my commands I am giving you today, to love the Lord your God and worship him with all your heart and all your soul, I will provide rain for your land in the proper time, the autumn and spring rains, and you will harvest your grain, new wine, and oil. I will provide grass in your fields for your livestock. You will eat and be satisfied." The oil, of course, is olive oil. Now, notice that the Israelites, again, are told to command to, in fact, carefully command. Don't be slack about it. And right connected with commands is loving the Lord your God. Keep the commands. Love the Lord. They go together. That's how you love God. You keep his commands. And doing that, you worship him with all your heart, not just lip service, not just external compliance, not just forced compliance, but voluntary from the heart compliance with the law. This idea of worshiping God from the heart is seen in Deuteronomy 4:29. "But from there you will search for the Lord your God, and you will find him when you seek him with all your heart and all your soul." God says in verse 14, "I will provide rain for your land in the proper time, the autumn and spring rains." Well, the autumn rain is called the former rain, and the spring rain is called the latter rain. In fact, in some translations, I think it translates it that way. The autumn rains, the former rains, began the rainy season in Palestine. As the NIV Study Bible notes, the former rains begin in September or October, September/October, according to Jameson Fawcett Brown, the Holman Christian Study Bible note. Adam Clark says they start in November. That's a little bit later than the consensus. So we're going to say September and October for the autumn rain, the spring rains. The latter rain is in March or April, and that ends the rainy season. And the latter rain, of course, helps with the harvest. The latter rain is associated with harvest. That's why you often hear people metaphorically speak about, "Oh, God, send the latter rain," meaning spits, let there be a harvest of souls for the kingdom. Now, between the former rain and the latter rain, the rain was very sparse, actually, in Israel, as Jameson Fawcett Brown and Adam Clark point out. So that makes the former and latter rains, the autumn and spring rains, more prominent and more necessary and more appreciated by the Israelites. We go now to Deuteronomy 11, verses 16 through 17. "Be careful that you are not enticed to turn aside, worship, and bow down to other gods. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you. He will close the sky, and there will be no rain. The land will not yield its produce, and you will perish quickly from the good land the Lord is giving you." Notice how God starts with the carrot and ends up with a stick. If you obey the law, good things will happen. Lots of rain, lots of prosperity. But if you don't obey the Lord, and you end up worshiping idols, then you're going to die. You will perish quickly. You're not going to last. There's not going to be any rain. Now, God is saying here that he controls those autumn and spring rains, the former and latter rains. They were controlled by God, not by Baal. The Canaanites erroneously thought Baal controlled the former and latter rains, but no, it was God. We go now to Deuteronomy 11, verses 18 through 21. "Imprint these words of mine on your hearts and minds. Bind them as a sign on your hands, and let them be a symbol on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates, so that as long as the heavens are above the earth, your days and those of your children may be many in the land the Lord swore to give your fathers. Imprint these words of mine on your hearts. That reminds us of Psalms 119, verse 11. I have treasured your word in my heart so that I may not sin against you. And that's the idea. Memorize the scripture, meditate the scripture, get familiar with the scripture. You put it in your heart, and that is a bulwark against personal sin. Now, if I told you to imprint the words of God on your hearts, would you think that I'm asking you to cut open your heart and put a rubber stamp on your beating organ in your chest? And then if I told you to imprint God's words on your minds, would that mean that I wanted you to saw open your skull and then put a stamp of God's words on your brain? Of course not. You wouldn't take that literally. But interestingly, when we get to the next phrase in verse 18, bind them as a sign on your hands. Well, now, the Jews took that literally. Let them be a symbol on your foreheads. The Jews took that literally. And I'm going to go off on a little rabbit trail, a little rant here about, no, Jewish phylacteries are a product of hyper-literalism and not interpreting the scripture in a reasonable fashion. The first problem with taking it literally is the verse itself says it's a sign or a symbol. Verse 18, bind them as a sign on your hands or bind them as a symbol on your hands. Well, that ought to tell you right now that no such thing as a literal phylactery, a little wooden box with a scripture written on a piece of paper stuck in the box. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that this is probably meant to be taken symbolically. Probably? I don't think so. I think it's certainly meant to be taken symbolically. Let me give you a description from John Gill of describing what the Jews did about these verses. Quote, write in a scroll of parchment this section with some passages, and as the Targum of Jonathan here, fix them in three places, over against the bedchamber, upon the post of the house, and on the gate at the right hand of it. And this is what they call the mezuzah, and the account giving of it is this. In a parchment prepared for the purpose, they write the words in Deuteronomy 6 and Deuteronomy 11, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, and Deuteronomy 11, 13 through 20, and then roll up the parchment and write on it Shaddai, and put it either into a cane or a reed, or else into a like hollow piece of wood, and so fasten it to the wall on the post of the door and at the right hand of entrance. And thus, as often as they go in and out, they make it a part of their devotion to touch this parchment and kiss it. Well, that's talking about the mezuzah on the sides of the doorpost of the house. They also made phylacteries to put these little boxes they would put on their left wrist, the left forearm, and also in the middle of their forehead. Some of the Jews, as Adam Clark said, even went so far as to create amulets out of these phylacteries to drive out ghosts. NIV Study Bible says this, quote, many Jews take these verses literally and tie phylacteries to their forehead and left arms. They also attach mezuzah, small wooden or metal containers in which passages of scripture are placed, to the door frames of their houses. Adam Clark also mentioned that one of the mezuzahs put somewhere opposite the bedroom. I don't know where he got that from. I'm sure he's right, but you don't hear about that so much. But on the doorpost you do. The mezuzah on the doorpost, the phylacteries on the body, on the person of the Jew, on the left forearm and the forehead of the Jew, to keep the scripture in on there. And the symbolism of this is, let's talk about the symbolism. You put the scripture on your forearm, that's your hand, that's where you move and do things. So the law will guide what you do. You put it on your forehead, that's in front of your brain, so the scripture will guide how you think. It's a great symbol. It's a shame the Jews are big on making a symbol out of it rather than, at least the Pharisees during the time of Jesus, did they actually practice what the law said? Of course they didn't. Jesus spent a ton of time complaining about the Pharisees' lack of obeying God's commands, even though they might have had those phylacteries right there on their forehead. Here's some other scriptures using that similar expression, binding on your hand and on your forehead, to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt and to a reasonable certitude that this is meant to be taken symbolically. Let's read Deuteronomy 6, verses 8 through 9. Bind the scriptures as a sign on your hand and let them be a symbol on your forehead. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates the word as sign in our verse here in Deuteronomy 11, but in Deuteronomy 6, it's translated as symbol. That makes it just a little bit more clear. A symbol, S-Y-M-B-O-L. So these phylacteries and mezuzah were symbols, not literal. Now let's look at Exodus 13:9. Let it, referring to the Passover, serve as a sign for you on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead. Well, now, are we going to put some Passover lamb, put it on our left forehead, forearm, and then get some bitter herbs and put them right in the middle of our forehead? Well, of course not. The Passover is a symbol. And as a matter of fact, it's called a symbol right there in verse 9. Let the Passover serve as a sign, as a symbol on your hand, a symbol on your hand, not a physical Passover on your hand. Exodus 13:16. So let it, this is referring to the Exodus, so let the Exodus be a sign on your hand and a symbol on your forehead. How are we going to put the Exodus literally on our hand and literally on our forehead? This is obviously symbolic, and it's using exactly the same expression as we have with the mezuzah and the phylacteries. Sign on the hand, symbol on the forehead. All right, enough of that rabbit trail. Let's go to verse 21. So that as long as the heavens are above the earth, your days and those of your children may be many. So now does that mean that the children of Israel are going to live on the land as long as the heavens are above the earth? Well, that's an awful long time. I mean, that's till the end of time. Well, that's obviously a hyperbolic expression. It's not meant to be taken literally. For one reason, the reason it can't be taken literally is because Israel has not possessed the land for a long, long time. From 8070 to 8948, there was no Israel. God promises in verse 21 that the days of your children may be many. The children are going to live for a long time. This sounds much like Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Not just the current generation of Israelites, but the descendants too will live if they keep the law. We go now to Deuteronomy 11, verses 22 through 25. For if you carefully observe every one of these commands I am giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, walk in all his ways, and remain faithful to him, the Lord will drive out all these nations before you, and you will drive out nations greater and stronger than you are. Every place the sole of your foot treads will be yours. Your territory will extend from the wilderness to Lebanon and from the Euphrates River to the Mediterranean Sea. No one will be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put fear and dread of you in all the land where you set foot, as he has promised you. Now in verse 22, God says through Moses to the Israelites that you Israelites are to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways. To walk in the way of someone means to live out your life, to live and obey. Some other scriptures that are very similar to that. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you except to fear the Lord your God by walking in all his ways, to love him and to worship the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul? We just went over that verse in this chapter, verse 12. Micah 6:8. Mankind, he has told you what is good and what it is the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God. Again, the same theme of obey, obey, obey. In verse 22, the Holman Christian Study Bible has this phrase translated this way: you are to remain faithful to him. Remain faithful. Well, I've got better translations than that. The NIV says, hold fast to the Lord. The King James has the best translation of all, in my opinion, to cleave unto God. Cleave has the idea of hold on tight. Hold on desperately. Hold on for dear life. Let's look at some other examples of cleaving. Using the King James translation, Genesis 2:24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife. They shall be one flesh. Well, that's holding on pretty tight to your wife. Leaving your father and mother, leaving and cleaving. That's the famous leaving and cleaving verse. A verse that is violated more times than I care to think. But the idea is you hold fast to your wife. Likewise, you're supposed to hold fast to God. Now, Ruth held fast to Naomi in Ruth 1:14, and they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah, this is Ruth and her mother-in-law, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. Clave is the past tense of cleave. So they hugged each other and held on for dear life. Here's some other scriptures, Deuteronomy 4:4, but ye that did cleave unto the Lord your God are alive, every one of you. If you held on to him, held fast to him, remained faithful to him, Deuteronomy 13:4, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and cleave unto him. Hold fast unto him, remain faithful unto him. Deuteronomy 30:20, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him. For he is thy life, and the length of thy days, cleave unto him. That's one guy. I usually don't like the King James translation, but I do like the King James there. It brings home the point very well, I think. Now let's look at verse 23. The Lord will drive out all these nations before you. That's the seven Canaanite nations, the chief of which were the Amorites. He will drive them out. He'd already promised that, or Moses had already mentioned that promise in Deuteronomy 7:1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, and he drives out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and powerful than you. So you obey the commandments, these powerful nations go bye-bye. Verse 24, every place the sole of your foot treads will be yours. Now, basically, that's the promise of the land. I guess I should read the rest of the verse there. Every place that your foot treads on will be yours. Your territory will extend from the wilderness to Lebanon and from the Euphrates River to the Mediterranean Sea. The wilderness is the wilderness in the south, the Negev in the south, all the way to Lebanon in the north. And then in the east, you got the Euphrates River, and that and runs all the way to the Mediterranean Sea on the west. So basically, those four boundaries are north, south, east, and west. You're going to get it all. Nobody will stand against you, as he has promised you. Well, now, where did God promise them to have the land of Canaan? Well, I'm going to give you the land promises given first to Abraham, repeated to Abraham's son Isaac, and repeated to Isaac's son Jacob, the patriarchs. Genesis 15:18-21. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, I give this land to your offspring, from the brook of Egypt to the Euphrates River, the land of the Ites. I'm not going to read them all. From the brook of Egypt, that's the Wadi El Arish in the south, right on the border of Egypt, south of in the Negev Desert, to the Euphrates River, which is the northeast of Israel, going toward Damascus and Syria. So God promised all that land to Abraham. This is the famous land promise. Now, in Genesis 26:2-3, we see the promise of the land was given to Isaac. The Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land that I tell you about. Stay in this land as a foreigner, and I will be with you and bless you, for I will give all these lands to you and your offspring. And I will confirm the oath that I swore to your father Abraham. Well, that was Isaac got the land promise. Now, Jacob got the land promises in Genesis 35:12. I will give to you the land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, and I will give the land to your future descendants. Okay, well, just to rehash here, in chapter 11 of Deuteronomy, verse 25, it says, God will put the dread of you in all the land as he has promised you. And I just gave you the promise, the promises of the fathers. Were referred to there, and I went back and spelled them out for you. Now, the next question is, well, before I go there, let me give you an idea the rabbis had. When it says, every place the sole of your foot treads will be yours, the rabbis interpreted that verse as saying that any place a Jew went belonged to the Jew. Well, now, isn't that nice? He could be a Jewish person could be walking in South Carolina. Whoops, South Carolina's yours. He could be walking in Yemen. Oh, Yemen's yours. I mean, that's absurd, actually. It's not what it's talking about. It's talking about the promised land. Now, the interesting question, we know that the land was promised there, but the interesting question is was the promise fulfilled? Well, yes, it was. 1 Kings 4:21, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. They offered tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So from the Euphrates River in the east to the land of the Philistines in the west, that's the same thing as the Mediterranean Sea, because the Philistines lived on the Mediterranean Sea. So there's your promised land right there, east to west. And as far as the border of Egypt, that's to the south of the Negev there, the Wadi El Arish. Now, the only thing that's not mentioned is Lebanon in the north, but you get the idea. The land was possessed by Solomon. The promise was fulfilled. We also see the promise was fulfilled by reading 2 Chronicles 9:26. He, referring to Solomon, ruled over all the kings from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines and as far as the border of Egypt. I think that's a parallel passage. But that, anyway, the point is that Solomon ruled. Now, the question is, if the promises are fulfilled, why do we postulate a future fulfillment in 1948? This is a theological question. It's aimed at dispensationalism, I must confess. I never have understood why people are always saying, oh, the land promise has been fulfilled in 1948. No, it wasn't. It was fulfilled in the times of Solomon, roughly 1,000 years earlier. Now, verse 25 refers to the fact that God would do as he had promised with regards to these land promises. And I mentioned where the promise was given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But these promises are referred to also in Deuteronomy 2:25. Today I will begin to put the fear and dread of you on the peoples everywhere under heaven. They will hear the report about you, tremble and be in anguish because of you. Actually, let me be more precise here. Verse 25 is talking about the fact that the Lord your God will put fear and dread of you in all the land where you set foot, as he has promised you. So more particular, these promises were referring to the promised land in general, but more particular to the fear and dread that the Israelites would produce when they went into the promised land. Now, let's read that idea of fear and dread that the Israelites would produce. Deuteronomy 2:25, today I will begin to put the fear and dread of you on the peoples everywhere under heaven. They will hear the report about you, tremble and be in anguish because of you. Exodus 15:14, this is in the middle of Moses' prophetic song at the Red Sea, the song of Moses. When the peoples hear, they will shudder. Anguish will seize the inhabitants of Philistia. The Israelites are coming. Mothers, hide your children. We turn now to Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 26 through 32, and we'll finish this chapter. Look, today I set before you a blessing and a curse. This is God still speaking through Moses to the people. There will be a blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God I'm giving you today, and a curse if you do not obey the commands of the Lord your God and you turn aside from the path I command you today by following other gods you have not known. Now that's the summary of the whole theme here of the second discourse of Moses to the people in Deuteronomy. The theme is obey, be blessed, disobey, be cursed. Verse 29, Deuteronomy 11, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim the blessing at Mount Gerizim and the curse at Mount Ebal. Aren't these mountains across the Jordan, beyond the western road in the land of the Canaanites who live in the Arabah, opposite Gilgal, near the oaks of Moreh? For you are about to cross the Jordan to enter and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you. When you possess it and settle in it, be careful to follow all the statutes and ordinances I set before you today. Blessings and curses. This is the famous passage of the blessings and curses, or at least it's the famous passages are actually in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, where you have curses, blessings, and curses. But this is the forerunner of it. This is where Moses said these blessings and curses were to be read out or proclaimed, not by him, of course, because he's not going into the promised land, but by Joshua. Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, they were mountains around a valley. In the valley was located Shechem, a famous city. That's the city that Abraham first went to when he left Haran in Syria and went into the promised land for the first time. The blessings were to be pronounced across that valley. The Israelites were to assemble in the valley, and then someone from the Israelites would read the blessings from Mount Gerizim in the south, and then somebody would read the curses from Mount Ebal in the north. It was probably antiphonal. And so this really put some stage effect to the law. Interestingly enough, Mount Gerizim on the south side of Shechem is very fruitful. And that's appropriate since the blessings would be proclaimed from there. And Mount Ebal to the north of the valley where Shechem was located, that mountain, Mount Ebal, was barren. And that's appropriate since curses would be spoken from there. Shechem, by the way, is about roughly halfway up the Arabah Valley, the Jordan River, from the northern tip of the Dead Sea to the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee, to help you locate it in your mind. Now, there's some geographical references here. The Arabah, that's the valley that the Jordan River was in, and Shechem was right there at the edge of the Arabah there as you crossed into going from west to east. I say it's on the edge of the valley. It's close. Let's put it this way. According to the map, it's close to the Arabah Valley. And it says the Canaanites lived there in the Arabah, which was close by, opposite Gilgal. That's not the same Gilgal, probably, that Joshua first led the people of Israel into when they crossed the Jordan. This is another Gilgal. Joshua's Gilgal was much further south. It's interesting, the map I have of BibleAtlas.org, it has the Gilgals labeled in parentheses with Deuteronomy 11 and Joshua something something here so you can distinguish the Gilgal. And then there's another Gilgal halfway in between them, a part way in between them in the Arab Valley close to the Jordan River, all three of which have question marks. So the scholars don't exactly know where Gilgal is. But this Gilgal is a different Gilgal, I'm sure, than the south one. And then there's a western road that's mentioned. Kylan Dillich identifies that road as a road which runs north from Asia, Syria, all the way down to Egypt, and it runs north and south down the Arab Valley, just like there was a road running north and south on the other side of the Arab Valley, which makes sense. It's easy to put roads in valleys, and the mountains are beyond that western road because you cross the western road to get to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim near the Oaks of Moreh in that valley there. Apparently, the Canaanites had set up a famous pagan sanctuary at Shechem in the valley. Pagan sanctuaries often had large trees conspicuously planted at such places. The Jameson, Foster, and Brown said it was more precisely not an oak tree, but a terebinth tree, which is very common in Palestine. This tree was remarkable for its wide-spreading branches and dark green foliage. Now, the Valley of Moreh, let's see what Easton's dictionary has to say about that. Moreh means an archer or a teacher or fruitful. The person Moreh was a Canaanite, probably who inhabited the district south of Shechem between Mounts Ebal and Gerizim, and gave his name to the plain there. Here at this plain, or rather oak of Moreh, Abraham built his first altar in the land of Palestine, and here the Lord appeared unto him. He afterwards left this plain and moved southward and pitched his tent between Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. Now, the plain of Moreh is how the King James has it. All the other translations have the oak of Moreh. So we're going to assume the Oak of Moreh is accurate, but it's basically the land around Shechem, which is in the valley between Mount Ebal to the north, Mount Gerizim to the south. Now, that western road I just referred to, let me give you a more precise description from Kylan Dillich. Quote, on the other side of the road of the west, that quoting the King James, which runs through the land on the west of the Jordan, just as another such road runs through the land on the east. The reference is to the main road which ran from Upper Asia, that would be up in Syria, through Canaan to Egypt, as was shown by the journeys of Abraham and Jacob. So that's a north-south road running up and down the Arab Valley to the west. All right, with all those geographical details, we are now finished with Deuteronomy chapter 11. Of course, the chapter is mainly about obeying and serving God. Good things happen if you do, bad things happen if you don't. Get a real quick and dirty summary of the chapter. This prepares us to go in our next audio to Deuteronomy chapter 12, which will refer to the Lord's chosen place of worship, which of course ended up being Jerusalem. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.